It's Success Happens on 930 WFMD, a discussion with leaders who share their pathways to success. Success Happens with your host, Jen Charlton.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Success Happens. And it is another fabulous day and a great show lined up. And I'm very excited about my guests. And unfortunately, it's because of some of the recent happenings that have us all very concerned about our health and our safety. And I felt it was important and relevant. You know, you cannot cause success in your own life if you don't have the capacity, either within yourself because you feel like you can tackle what there is to tackle to cause success. You know, you got to have your, I used to have a boss who said to me, get rid of your stinking thinking. And you guys have heard me say that before. And so you have to kind of let go of some of the things that overwhelm us and be able to focus. And when you can't, you got to get help to do that. So, you know, as we're looking back on what happened in Florida, it became very clear to me that we have a mental health crisis in the U.S. here. And you know, as I've talked to a ton of people about this, but nobody wants to talk about it. Like, shh, don't mention, you know, or, boy, I can't tell somebody I'm not feeling well right now because what will they think? You know, so rather than really deal with the elephant in the room, we're suffering. And then we're finding out that people around us are suffering we didn't even know about because when somebody says, how are you doing? You say, oh, I'm good. You know, you mentioned, yeah, you know, you don't talk about your headache and your feet hurt and you, or maybe you're depressed. So we have to start opening the dialogue up to people being able to talk about what they're really dealing with. And it starts by being a great listener. You know, when we're willing to listen, people feel safe to share a lot of times. So, you know, as we talk today, I thought it important to bring on the two issues and kind of marry them together. One is mental health. What is it? How do we make sure we are attending to our mental health? And also, and I have an expert here to talk about that. And then how does that work with law enforcement? How do we ensure that people who aren't feeling well aren't putting others at risk? Right. So I have with me today Dr. Tim Gibbion, who is a forensic psychologist. And I have our returning favorite Sheriff Chuck Jenkins with us. And I thought, what a great opportunity to really look together at what do we need to do as a society to deal with the issues. And, you know, unfortunately, and I'm just going to get on my soapbox one more second here. How do you keep the masses safe but not give up your own personal rights? You know, the Second Amendment exists for a reason. The founders created it way back when for a very specific reason. So we have to manage ourselves inside of those commitments. So all of that being said, welcome, guys. It's great to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I thought I'd start with Dr. Tim, and perhaps you could share first what it means to be a forensic psychologist.
A forensic psychologist is a psychologist that uses the science of psychology or this what we know from psychological research in a forensic capacity. So that could be in the criminal world where you're talking about mitigating circumstances, possibility of future violence. It could also be in civil law. The area where I do most of my forensic psychology work is in family law. So I consult on many cases involving parenting, custody, some domestic violence, some child abuse cases, and that sort of thing.
So in your opinion, and we only have one hour for this show, which we could spend 2 days on, so we'll have to kind of do it at a very high level. But when you see someone who has suffered either the effects of domestic violence, and there's an impact on that person because of it, or somebody who has committed domestic violence, do you think that should somehow inform us as to how they should be allowed to have access to guns?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, you're talking about two different
Correct.
People. One is the victim, one is the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator.
But we know that sometimes it's a generational thing. So if somebody's been abused, they sometimes may become an abuser, right?
That's probably more true for the effects of violence on children and exposure to domestic violence if you're a child. I guess I was just thinking mostly of the two adults, the one spouse, let's say, abusing the other, and what that what the victim's going to do and what the perpetrator is going to do.
So there's a lot there to kind of assess as to where it's appropriate that there should be guns. We're going to deal specifically with guns today in the household. Okay, very good. And Chuck, in terms of your perspective on access to guns for anybody who's dealing with a mental health issue, and I know that you guys are all looking at that right now, and there's been a lot of chatter about it this week in Congress. What is your opinion on that?
Well, let me take a step back and say that the mental health issue that we deal with as a dynamic in law enforcement goes far beyond the domestic violence. I mean, every day on the street, we're dealing with people who are homeless, who have mental health issues, people who are arrested for drug addiction or drug possession or drug dealing, who have a part of that is due to mental health issues. I mean, a lot of your criminal activity you can relate to some type of mental health issue. Now, the problem is law enforcement is not really equipped to deal with that. We're trained. We train our people to deal with it on the street. We provide mental health care in our jail, but largely we're unequipped to deal with it. So taking a step back from that, I mean, I think we're at a real tipping point where we need to decide, you know, how do we effectively keep guns out of the hands of people who have mental health issues? And doctor, listen, I'm not a psychologist, don't pretend to be, but would you agree that a lot of these school shootings, these mass killing events, are people who are separated from reality?
Well, I guess in a common sense way, sure. We could say a reasonable person would never do that. But that really begs the bigger question of what is mental illness? How does it play a role in mass shootings? How does it play a role in violence in general? One of the things I want to point out is we're operating from a different perspective, you and I. You and your force are on the street. So you see people who are dealing with the effects of mental illness, and that's reflected in their social circumstances many times. The research actually shows that about 4% of violent behavior is due to mental illness. People may think that a lot of violent behavior is a function of mental illness, but it isn't. If you define mental illness in terms of psychosis like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, substance abuse, major depression, but 4%, that's really not that much.
Well, let me pick up on what you're saying, because on a continuum of severity of illness, those are the severe illnesses, right? Many times they're getting medications to manage that level of illness. But there's a whole plethora of mental illness that I think hasn't reached that critical level where people are out there. I'm thinking of the one in Frederick I was just reading up on that happened in Thurmont with Catoctin, where the young lady had the diary and she was frustrated, you said, and she was dealing with angst. Well, that's not a diagnosed, you know, schizophrenia. That's somebody who's troubled. And Chuck, do you have something to say that?
Yeah, well, let me take another step back to your original question. How do we keep firearms out of the hands of people who have been treated for or do have a mental illness problem? Because, honestly, the purchase of a firearm is based on an answer with the honor system. I mean, they rely on you to be honest. Well, people who have evil intent, and you can never predict evil intent, they're not going to be honest in the purchase of a firearm. So how do we do that without full disclosure? You have the HIPAA laws. I mean, we can't determine as law enforcement who may or may not have a mental illness issue.
Well, you have to have an assessment criteria. Do you have any thoughts about that, Doctor, about in terms of an assessment tool that you could use?
You mean for who might be at risk for violent behavior?
Yeah.
Let's talk about prediction. It used to be thought that you could predict violent behavior, or we hoped that we could predict violent behavior. And we looked at social science research, psychological research. We did a lousy job of predicting behavior. Why is that? Because, in fact, as much as sheriffs and police see this on, unfortunately, a regular basis, violent behavior doesn't occur that much in society. We really have to step back. It gets a lot of attention, but it doesn't occur that much. Things that don't occur that much are very hard to predict. You have what's called a low base rate. That makes them very hard to predict. So the model we use now is a risk assessment model.
Okay.
We look at different factors that go into predisposing somebody to acting violently. If you load high on them, you're at more risk. Notice that I'm not saying you can predict it. An individual, you cannot predict that a specific person is going to do a certain thing at a certain time at any great distance in time. You might say, well, probably in an hour, we're going to stand up and walk out of the studio. That's easy. But to say that somebody like a student in Thurmont is going to do something in a certain way, you're doing a risk assessment.
Well, and I would assert something. I think it's because we're not paying attention. We're not as a society attuned to that young lady's suffering in a way that we would be able to say, wow, you need to go see Dr. Tim.
Mm-hmm.
You're depressed. You're frustrated. You're feeling whatever you're feeling, and you need attention to that. You know, we have in human services where I work something called self-care. And I want to put that out there for people to deal with, because we have to sometimes be our best monitor to say, whoa, I'm not myself right now. I need to go do something to take care of me. And intervene before it gets to a point where we can't. Do you have any thoughts about that, Tim?
Obviously, I think we all have to be open to what's happening in ourselves. We have to be careful and it's attentive to the people we're close to, the people we work with. And we have to be willing to have an honest discussion with them. And you're right, we have to take the stigma out of it. Just opening it up for the discussion is often the hardest part. Most people appreciate it, especially if you do it in a careful, respectful, confidential way. It's a big step to go see a therapist. There's no doubt about it. It's not easy, but most people find relief.
You had asked a question about the situation in Thurmont.
Yeah.
So let's look at this young lady who, by all accounts, an outstanding student, no outwardly visible problems, that were seen by her teachers, her counselors, her parents, in fact. Good family. I know the family. Very good family. So whoever saw this coming? No signs, no outward signs whatsoever. This was something that she had within her that she wanted to carry out and honestly be the first female mass school shooter. And no one ever saw this coming. Had it not been, you know, for the grace of God, for the father happening to come across this diary, if you will, and see the details that were laid out and planned out, we were probably, I think, as I recall, about 4 or 5 days away from something really tragic going on up there.
So, well, and if you look
again,
at
going back to whoever sees this coming.
Right. Well, I was going to say in Florida, the parents so supposedly had no thought that this could happen. And yet he had been, you know, there had been police activity at the household. He had shown signs of depression 3 months prior.
I would beg the question. And listen, I'm not going to criticize that sheriff or the police down there, because I tell you, every situation is different. I've been in enough bad situations as the sheriff, head of the agency, so I understand the dynamic of all this. But I will tell you this. I have to really beg the question, after 39 visits from law enforcement, certainly during one of those visits, somebody would have seen something to do an EP, do a take him to the hospital for an emergency evaluation or something, somewhere along the line.
So we have today with us also calling in is Ami Hober, who's a candidate for Congressional District 6. And I wanted to bring Ami in to have a conversation about the federal laws. Because to me, when you look at, we can deal with this as a state matter or a local matter. But to me, at some point, there's some federal laws that need to be put in place as precautions. So perhaps, for example, across the country, you can't be under 21, which to me is that a kid could buy it at 18 is crazy to me anyway. You can't buy alcohol, but you can buy a gun. That's nuts. So there seems to be some platform basics that we need to put in place that could be done at the federal level. So I want to invite Ami in to that conversation. Ami?
Hi there. How are you?
Hey, Jen? Welcome. Good morning. Do you have any thoughts about that as somebody who's running for a federal office?
Well, one of my concerns is the restrictions of the HIPAA laws, because I think today the idea of transmitting medically related information about anybody is against the law. And I'm wondering how much this may constrain the communication of problems regarding mental health into databases that would be accessible for, you know, background checks for gun purchases.
Well, and if you think about it, and I've, of course, worked in healthcare, I'm very familiar with all the HIPAA constraints, it's to protect the patient for sure. And at what point, and I think you're pointing to this, is protecting the patient at the risk of others? So we really have to look at that as a society. And I think one of the issues and in talking with Dr. Tim here is there's a stigma attached with mental health. So if you have somehow the word gets out, okay, that you are somebody who's on a psych med or you are somebody who manages mental health issues through medications or something else, how are, you know, could that impact your ability to be employed?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is a two-edged sword, and it's obviously a problem. But I think certainly we have to figure out how to define when it is appropriate to, you know, warn people that someone may be a danger to the public or to their family or to their school.
Okay, Tim, you have a thought?
Well, actually, in psychology and mental health in general, this has been an issue that's been talked about for a number of years, and we are ethically required to break confidentiality when we know that an individual is a direct threat to a known individual. Now, that's a very specific situation.
Yeah.
There are situations where an individual is clearly troubled, has poor impulse control, is spouting scary stuff, but it's so general, I'm ethically barred from notifying the authorities. If I really feel that a specific person, for example, the person at home or a teacher is at risk, I'm going to call the authorities. I'm going to alert that person. And I tell new patients when they come in the first day, there's two times when I will break confidentiality, suspected child abuse or neglect, which I'm required to do by law, and if I think they're a risk to themselves or somebody else. So they know up front that that's going to happen. But there's a tremendous gray area where you worry and you have to constantly clinically assess and sometimes pull in other people to help you make that determination.
Okay, let me just interrupt. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back. I have with me Dr. Tim Gibeon, Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, and Ami Hober, candidate for Congressional District 6 on the phone. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton, and I have with me Sheriff Chuck Jenkins and Dr. Tim Gibeon. And we're talking about this very complicated marriage between mental wellness and the ability to protect and defend oneself with firearms. And so we were talking with Ami Hober on the line. Ami, you still there?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just want to wrap up with you on the whole federal issue. And I want to let people know, if you want to call in, call 301-694-9363. That's 301-694-WFMD. We'd love to hear from you. Ami, any further thoughts about how we might tackle this at the federal level?
I think we need to do some mandated federal standards on school safety equipment. For example, I think we need to have a rule that's tied in with providing federal funding for schools to things like ensuring that school doors are locked, outside school doors. I mean, for example, when I go visit the various high schools here in Montgomery County, I have to hit a buzzer in order to get in, and somebody actually has to come let me in. Now, this won't stop a determined shooter. There are lots of ways to get through a door, but it may delay someone. And I think a delay has some value here.
So in your experience, Ami, having worked around a lot of military, and one of my concerns, and I'll pose this to you, and then we'll wrap up, and Dr. Tim can kind of give his thoughts. You know, for military folks, many whom have seen and done things that are really dramatic and sometimes suffer PTSD, how do we, you know, the president has talked about bringing military people into these school systems. And is there a concern that, you know, how do we assess again? Are they able to carry appropriately? Do we want them in our schools? Do we want them carrying?
I don't think so. I think a better solution is to deal with the local police in a more coherent fashion. There are two things that I would suggest. Perhaps an agreement between the schools and the local police department that there's always in the patrols that the police always are conscious of where the nearest school is and how far away they are from it.
All right. Well, we're going to get Chuck's opinion on that. He's got something to say about that. The other thing I'll mention is you had a young man there who didn't go in.
Yeah. Well, listen, Ami, the issue is much larger than security in schools, because if not targeting schools, you're going to be targeting school buses, public events such as ball games, you name
the
it.
The mall.
The mall, anywhere. So it's the larger question is, and I think the doctor would agree with me, how do we effectively limit access of firearms to people who shouldn't possess firearms? And I don't think it's a gun control thing at all. I think there are effective ways to do that, but we have to be willing to give a little bit.
So my request would be, though, again, that at the federal level, we have a cross-the-board 21 age limit. You got to be 21 to purchase a firearm. That's my thing.
Let me take a step back. I think it should be 21 to purchase a regulated firearm, which would be a handgun or a semi-automatic AR-type rifle. I think for a shotgun, a rifle, for a young man at age 18 to purchase that for sports use, for hunting, I think that's fine.
Yeah,
okay.
I would agree.
Okay. But I think for any regulated firearm, absolutely 21 across the board, no exceptions, if with the exception of a person that's 18 or older in the military.
Military.
So make that
or
exception.
Or police. They could be
police.
Well,
you can't be police until you're 21.
Oh, you
so
can't. Okay.
I think there's a common sense way to approach that aspect of it.
I agree.
All right. Well, we all agree. That was good. Okay,
yeah,
Tim.
No, I think that's fine. I have absolutely no problem with that. But I do think we also need to strengthen the ability to do background checks even over the age of 21.
We need definitely better background checks. I think everybody agrees on that. Ami, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for calling in and spending some time with us this morning. Okay, Dr. Tim, just before we go to break, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, somebody mentioned a delay, and I think it was in reference to getting into a school. But actually, I want to step back and take a look at delay in buying a firearm. There's actually research that shows if you impose only a 2 to 7 day delay period before you, from purchasing to acquiring the weapon, homicides drop by 7%. Imagine that. Excuse me, 25%. From 2 to 7 days, you can get a 1/4 drop in homicides. And that's because many of these behaviors are impulsive in nature.
Wow. Okay.
And
on
doctor,
that note,
particularly suicides, you don't know how many people will go out to Walmart, buy a shotgun today, and carry out that suicide tonight.
We'll talk about that.
Okay. And we're going to go to break. We'll talk about that when we get back. Great, you guys. You're listening to Success Happens. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Xerox Complete Document Solutions and Sweeties on the Creek. We're scooping now. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton, and I have with me today Dr. Tim Gibeon, who is a forensic psychologist, and Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, who is a local and now national celebrity. And just really great to have the two of you together talking about the impact of mental health and wellness. Because sometimes it's not illness, it's wellness, and the ability to carry a firearm. And so we were talking before the break, and I thought, Tim, you said something that was shocking, which was if somebody is delayed 2 to 7 days in the from the point of time that they purchase the gun to the point of time they receive the gun, homicide rate goes down 25%. Did I restate that correctly?
That was the one study I read, yes.
Okay, great. Can you talk about, and then we've got a bunch of callers, so I want to take some calls. Tim, can you talk about suicide, because we were talking offline about that, what the impact on suicidal rates is.
Sure. I'm going to do a little quiz, though.
Okay, good.
Of our host.
I'm going to
put you on
no.
the hot seat, Jen.
Oh, no.
Here
oh,
it
no.
goes. Okay. I got these. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, down in Atlanta, gathers statistics on homicide, suicide, all kinds of health behaviors. I'm going to ask you, in 2014, nationwide, about how many suicides were there in the U.S.?
Oh, my goodness.
Just guess.
How many, as a number, not a percent?
Okay. Completed, yeah.
Golly, I don't even know where to begin with that. 2,500?
Oh. More. Try 44,000 plus.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
My mind said 42. I was thinking about 42.
Yeah.
Wow.
It goes up about 1,000, 1,500 every year as the population grows.
Wow.
Okay. Now, how many of those suicides, completed suicides, were accomplished with a firearm?
I don't know.
Over half.
Wow.
Slightly over half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, so that gives us about 22,000 that in 2014 completed suicide with a firearm. How many people died by a firearm in homicides and accidents in the same year. So 22,000 plus in suicide.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
About half of that. So actually, when you talk about firearms, statistically, the issue is suicide, not violent crime. That sounds shocking to people, but from a purely public health point of view, the issue is suicide.
Well, that's great to hear your professional opinion on that, because I think that does give us some perspective. I want to shoot over to Bob Coyote, Bob, who's on the phone with us. Welcome, Bob.
Yeah, I've got a little question for the sheriff and for the doctor, separate questions. Sheriff, what can be done to harden these gun-free zones, because that seems to be the majority of all the shootings. I can only think of one in the past 20 years that was in the not in a gun-free zone, to harden them to where they're less of a target.
Well, obviously, secure-type improvements, physical security improvements of the facilities themselves. You can go with metal detectors. You can build solid walls around the playgrounds, the school grounds. You know, I don't know if we want to go down that road, but I've got a thought process, and I've actually thought this through and discussed it with Brad Young about establishing security teams within a school made up of faculty members who are well-trained and well-equipped to engage a situation. That'll probably never sell. I'm not talking about arming all school teachers, but
percentage of your team would need to be carrying.
I'm just thinking a security team that is well-trained to carry this out, maybe five or six faculty members in every school in Frederick County or anywhere, trained to engage and you know, they maintain the training proficiency to do this, because one of two things has to happen. And again, I'm not a psychologist, but I think either we need to see a societal change, which I don't think we will, or we need to figure out a way to harden our vulnerable targets.
Well, and, you know, people talk about, wow, now you expect, you know, them to be marksmen as well as a math teacher. But if you think about it, if somebody has the skill called I speak a second language, Spanish, that makes you more marketable. If you are somebody who is a teacher, perhaps it makes you more marketable if you have that skill.
But just understand, the whole purpose of this is only to engage and get involved in a catastrophic situation with an active shooter event.
Right.
And the only people that have to know who these faculty members and teachers are the principal, the assistant principals, and law enforcement.
Got that. Thank you, Bob, for your question. We have another caller, please. We lost Bob. Sorry about that. Call back, Bob. And do we have another caller?
Gus.
Hi, Gus. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing this morning?
Very good. Thank you.
Hey, Chuck, I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
And I know you personally, you know me, we fought fire together for many years back. But here's my question is, when does it go from anger to mentally insane?
That's probably a better question for the doctor, honestly. You know, people do act out their anger at all levels. It's impossible for me to know when it's simply anger and when it's a true mental health issue. So I'm going to defer that question to the doctor.
So that's a very good question. It really begs a much larger question of what is the difference between mental health and mental illness. So anger is not a mental disorder. It's not a mental illness. It is part of a number of diagnostic categories. But by itself, it's
an emotion.
It is exactly.
Very good. It's a great question. Do you have anything else, Gus?
Yeah. The thing is, because I'm glad he answered that, but then again, this is back to Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, who was a great sheriff and done a great job for this county. I'm saying that everybody, like the shooters in Las Vegas, Nevada, Parkland, Florida, Newtown, Connecticut, San Diego, California, that's a tactical approach, right or wrong, Sheriff?
Well, the way they carried out these situations was a tactical approach, but I don't think it defines whether it was necessarily anger or mental health. I can't imagine ever having the thought in my mind of carrying out something like this.
When you say tactical approach, explain that for the listeners.
Well, the way they carried out the attacks.
In other words, well thought through.
They are well thought through. They're well planned way prior to, because generally you will find something, either a diary, some type of writings, something posted on their social media website of how they're going to carry this out. It's not something you wake up this morning and say, I'm going to attack this school. You know,
Great. Okay. So let's throw it to the doctor. And Gus, thank you very much for your comments. I want to ask the doctor, in the event a parent, and in the instance of the young lady in Thurmont, the parent intervened. What are the signs of a young person who's struggling, who may be plotting? How would someone notice behavior that could be put them in that category?
Well, there are two categories of, we'll call them behaviors or symptoms, if you will, that you want to look at. One are generic to psychological dysfunction. The second are specific to the risk, increased risk for violent behavior. So you're looking at social withdrawal, gradual or abrupt changes in mood, changes in association, peer association, changes in grades.
In other words, they're withdrawing, they're quiet, they're solemn, depressed.
Now, this could be somebody who has no intention to be harming anybody but is simply getting depressed or kids are making fun of them, something you see every day and you can deal with clinically or just in the home, in the school. But I think it really...
Okay, so wait, though. I think part of it is we must intervene at that point. That's when you start to see this stuff. You say, whoa, okay, where do we get help? So where do they go? Right now, that's happening in their home. The child is withdrawing. There's some signs of something going on. Where do they go?
The three places most parents go to is school, physician, clergy, and I should say fourth, a mental health professional. So they'll talk to the priest or rabbi or the minister. They'll talk to a guidance counselor. They'll call me. But these are generic. We don't have any idea yet. So a good clinical interview, follow-up. I'm always encouraging parents to be aware of what's in their house and to be frank with their children about what's going on. One of the things we were talking about this at the break a little bit. I was asking the sheriff about access to firearms in homes. I think it's absolutely incumbent on parents or adults in the home to have all their firearms locked and the children or the minors not to have access to the safe.
Well, and this is what I want to put in with everybody. Responsible gun ownership. That's a basic.
Absolutely.
You got to have the stuff locked up and not accessible to kids, period. So, so back to this idea of intervening. They're getting the help. I would like to see the faith community, whichever faith you choose, step up and start offering some of this group kind of counseling. Because I think that, one, connecting to our faith is always a good thing. Two, in a group environment, people with their peers might feel compelled to share, and then we can start to deal with this because there aren't enough of you, Tim, to go around. The problem is mental health care is very expensive, and it's very limited access. It's hard to get to.
But, Tim, let me throw something back to you here. In the case, again, going back to the situation in Catoctin High School, honest to gosh, everything I know of this, the parents absolutely saw nothing. Again, an honor student, worked jobs, as a high school student, had friends, not real socially outgoing, but by all accounts, nobody really saw anything. So what do we do with that?
Okay. But he checked the diary.
Right.
But only by the grace of God, he found the diary.
He checked the diary.
So if he never finds a diary.
Check the diaries, guys. So that's a start.
When it comes to mass shootings, there are two basic types. They're the impulsive type. We're actually pretty good at not predicting, but getting a good risk assessment on. Then there's the predatory or the directed type, which this young lady in Thurmont was doing, which Las Vegas was doing, which this young man down in Florida was doing. Those are very hard to predict and to locate. They are so discreet. And thankfully, they are very unusual. But that's part of what makes them so hard to
locate.
Well,
and don't get me started on our God love them, the FBI. And I know some people who've worked for the FBI, and they're fabulous people. And that system did not deliver. I'm going to take a call quick. Coyote Bob is back. Hi, Bob. Yeah, sorry about that.
Doctor, too. He can. One of his clues he can look for is it seems I've heard most of the mass shooters are on the reuptake inhibitor drugs, and that may be a clue to point at where you need to look harder.
As far as I know, there's no research to indicate that people are at more risk for acting violently when they're on what are called SSRIs. So
okay.
They may be on those drugs because of depression or anxiety, but as far as I know, they do not predispose you to gun violence.
Okay, very good. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Success Happens. I have with me today Dr. Tim Gibbion and Sheriff Chuck Jenkins. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Xerox Complete Document Solutions, Sweeties on the Creek, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Success Happens. This is Jennifer Charlton, and I just want to build upon what I said right before the break, which was kind of a slam on the FBI. But, you know, it really is. We're asked to see something, say something, then they got to do something. And that was a system failure. We all know that, right? And they'll put I'm sure they are dealing with what there is to do to fix that for the future. I want to take a call from Gene, and then we're going to wrap up the show. Gene, do you have a quick comment or question?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a retired public safety official, and I like the approach you're taking with this, and I'll concede because I'm an outdoor enthusiast. I'll give, and it's going to take away some people's rights up to age 21. But, doctor, do you see, as I've actually witnessed, a point in this country where we had turned, and this has happened in the last, 20 years, and maybe date back 25 years, a turn in the way the people are acting this out? What is some common things, and have these people been interviewed after the survivors? I'm talking about the ones who, you know, have been put down and are in jail or in hospital, to interview them, and why, and what's the common, is there a commonality in that?
Seems like many times, and it's a great question, Gene, many times they don't survive the incident. But in this case in Florida, we have the gentleman in custody. So are, I guess the question is really to both of you. Is law enforcement doing the appropriate questioning to understand it from what is the tipping point that sent him over the edge? And as a mental health professional, are you all identifying what there is to deal with so that it doesn't happen again?
I'll say this. In most situations, the person involved does not want to survive. They don't expect to survive in most cases. Now, beyond that, when they do survive, they are taken into custody. You know, we certainly do the best we can to question, interrogate, find out their motivations, find out, you know, what they've done in their past, do everything we can to get all the information we can. But largely, you're limited. They lawyer up. So we're limited to the information we get.
No, I agree completely with the sheriff. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, there is no profile. It's not interviewing these people will not yield you a psychological or behavioral profile that you can take and with great accuracy or reliability locate other potential perpetrators. Look at this young woman in Catoctin High School.
Yeah, very good. Mm-hmm. Thank you,
Gene.
Student. Do you have any other comment?
No, not at this time. I appreciate the forum, and I hope it's visited again.
Very good. We'll keep on it. Thank you. So, you know, we're...
Can I make a statement
that's
been in my mind? I thought about this. I was having breakfast this morning with my breakfast gang there, and we were talking about this whole thing. And I really believe it's such a societal change. You know, people have separated themselves from reality through these terrible video games that they're playing there as young kids and teenagers. You know, we've gotten away from society being what it was, where, you know, America was the good guy and the good guys won. And you know, when we grew up, I had a set of cap guns and toy guns, and we played Army and Cowboys. And
it was cops and robbers.
Yeah, and you know what? We never had these problems until the past maybe 20 years, two decades, until Columbine. Since Columbine, this has been a steady, ongoing pattern of these types of behaviors.
And I hear, here's what I'm hearing. I'm so glad you brought that up, Chuck.
One more comment while you're thinking.
Yeah,
I despise social media.
Refuse to have a Facebook page.
Every segment of social media has done nothing but, I think, but harm to this society. And I'll let it go.
Well, all right. Get on that soapbox. So,
thank you for that liberal comment.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think if you were to look, is there a correlation between the uprising and popularity, to your point, of gaming to current reality in terms of people taking these actions? Now, one comment I want your professional opinion, Tim. Is it related to the dopamine levels? They're seeing mental chemical changes from gaming and they're saying it's somewhat like a drug impact. So can you speak to that as a professional?
I can't speak to changes in brain chemistry from gaming. I know that they're studying that a lot. I can tell you this. I hate to throw cold water on your argument that gaming is.
I'm looking for a reason to pull my 6-year-old away from gaming.
It does appear to have a low level effect on certain social behaviors in young people. I don't mean teenagers. I mean elementary school, middle school kids. They might throw an elbow on the playground when they normally wouldn't have. But as far as this high profile violent behavior, we just haven't been able to find it.
Because they're calling it desensitizing.
Yeah, but it desensitizes at a very low level among some kids at a very young age. The factor that we're seeing more of is the availability of firearms. That is the factor that's out there.
Chuck, you shook your head.
I just respectfully disagree. I mean, that is a piece of it. I would admit to that, sure. But I think we do common sense restrictions to limit that availability. I think that's very, very reasonable. I have no problem with that.
All right. I said, let me take one more call from Connie. Welcome to Success Happens.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good. Very good. Thank you for calling. What is your brief comment or question?
You know, I have a comment. I have a couple comments, but I know I don't want to, you know, use up all the time. I cannot put it in my mind or comprehend how a person that we say that's mentally disturbed, how can they gather all this information to go out and do something this evil? A person like that, I don't think their mind can work like that.
Connie, do you know where they get a lot of this? Online. They see past events. They look at the information they can get out of these, these post-event information that's out there on the internet, on social media and things. And based on the things that have already occurred, that's how they plan what they're going to do next. And again, I go back to the Thurmont situation where it was documented in this young lady's diary of exactly what the failings were at Columbine and how she was not going to make the same mistakes.
Wow.
And she found all that on social media.
So, you know, if we step back to a societal – thank you, Connie, so much for your comment and call. That was great. You know, when you step back and you look at it as a societal issue, maybe this is where we wrap this show up. You know, how do we – have we gotten away from God, family, human interactions? Are we so disconnected from one another through technology that we are not looking at each other eyeball to eyeball and thinking about there's a heartbeat over there? You know, there's a brain over there. There's a son, a daughter, a family member over there. You know, have we lost sight of the relatedness, doctor?
I guess in a general sense, I feel like we're in our silos to some extent. But here's a problem with the argument that maybe a decrease in faith is part of the problem. If you look at Europe, they go to church a lot less. They report feeling religious way less. Their violent crime rate and their gun rate is at the floor compared to us. The United States is a fairly religious, liberal democracy, and I use liberal in small L. We go to church more. We claim to be faith-based more.
You mean liberal in terms of freedoms?
Yes, open, a civil liberal society in the generic sense. But our gun violence and violence in general is much higher than in those countries. So it doesn't make sense to me that it is a faith issue. From a prevention point of view, it's a gun issue.
Well, and I want to just speak to this idea of the young man, for example, in Florida. And there's a lot to understand about his history and how he ended up with the family he did. You know, if people have suffered domestic violence – and I'm not accusing that family who took him in of that at all. But I'm just saying, if someone was born substance exposed, this is something we need to be dealing with as a society because of all the drugs, it's really an impact. So, what is it that we need to? Let's say there's three things we want to come out of this conversation that we need to do. What are they? Tim, what's something we need to do to start to impact this and make a difference?
Okay.
Your number one thing, what is it?
My number one thing is vote for people who are going to enact change at the local, state, and federal level that decreases access to firearms in a sensible, common sense way. Number two, you can call local resources if you don't know what to do. Here in Frederick, you can call Mental Health Association at 301-663-0011. They also have a 211 hotline, which you can call. They have a walk-in behavioral clinic, which has done amazing things. It's a great organization. You can call the Waste Station at 301-662-0099 if you've got issues about that relate more to a chronic mental health condition. I think you have to ask finally, just very directly with the people in your household, if you sense anything, ask directly, what are their thoughts? And then ultimately, I think you have to say, are you thinking of hurting yourself? Have you had any thoughts of hurting anybody else? It's a taboo subject, but I think we have to be willing to go that step.
We have to be willing to go there. Yeah, Chuck,
and your
thoughts?
And I would actually reverse the order of what he said, because I think it's more importantly to identify the problems in your home and your families, react and deal with those problems. Secondly, how do we establish and carry out more effective background checks? How do we identify the psychological problem to restrict purchases? Okay, I'll buy that. And to a smaller degree, yes, I would agree with common sense restrictions and laws to, you know, prohibit people under the age of 21 from acquiring regulated firearms. I have no problem with that. No problem with background checks. No problem with the elimination of these bump stocks or anything else that would replicate a fully automatic firearm.
And it's incumbent upon all of us to pay attention. If you see right. somebody who's withdrawn, there's something going on. And there's something to deal with. And, you know, I just want to thank both of you okay. for being here. We're at the top of the show. It has been an honor and a privilege to have you here. And thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
Okay. And Tim Gibbion, you can be found at Frederick.
Frederick Psychology Center.
Okay. Google them. All right. Everybody have a great week. Be safe. See something, say something, do something.